I'm so grateful that we have the Sangha so we can revisit what we've begun to talk about. It's so helpful, right, to have places where we can, with kindness, with mindfulness, you know, just speak openly and honestly about the impact of these situations. So, and it's not irrelevant to the topic of psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, since we're also talking about experiences that can be deeply disillusioning, for some can be traumatic. And I'll just start by saying that I'm not an expert in psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, but I have been privy to the inner workings of the research over quite a bit of time now, mostly because of Phil. And then over time, Phil has introduced me to other researchers in the field. So I've really appreciated learning more about the benefits of this modality. And I'm also very grateful to be able to talk about it with you, because as a student of the Dharma, it has seemed to me that an aspect of what's accessed in psychedelic assisted psychotherapy are experiences that are familiar to people who have a long-term contemplative practice. And so we can talk that through, what's similar and what's different. I won't be sharing any slides tonight. I'm just going to share a few notes, and then would love to hear from you. But maybe just as a starting point, many of you probably know this now, since psychedelics is just so front and center in popular culture. And so many people have seen documentaries and they've heard NPR reports, and it's hard actually not to hear about psychedelics as of late. But it has a very rich and complicated history, right? Almost 100-year history now among clinicians. And many clinicians have lamented that researchers were attempting to offer psychedelics as a needed resource at least 70, 80 years ago. And then those efforts got thwarted in part because of the FDA and other complications. People like Stan Grof, and more famously, Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, and Ram Dass, they were aware that psychedelics were a resource for healing and potentially a resource for addressing trauma. And then in the last really 30 years or so, we've accrued a tremendous amount of research through Hopkins, NYU, Brown, UCLA, there are a few other places, and now most notably MAPS, which is the organization that Phil has been involved with, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies. And MAPS has been overseen by Rick Doblin and the Mithoffers and other really substantive, grounded clinicians who have been extremely careful around the research protocols so that they don't run into the same snags that the original crew back in the 50s ran into, 40s and 50s. And now what's changed is it looks like the FDA is on board. And so the three primary medicines that researchers have been working with, which you probably know, is MDMA, psilocybin, and ketamine. It's looking like MDMA will be FDA approved within the next year or two. Psilocybin is not far behind. and ketamine is already approved because it's an anesthetic. And therefore, psychiatrists can work with it. They do work with it as a very effective treatment for severe clinical depression. And now MAPS has been training, I want to say upwards of 1,000 clinicians to partner with psychiatrists so that they can participate in psychedelic assisted psychotherapy by deepening the process, helping people really mine for meaning what they experience when they use the medicines with a psychiatrist. And so that's very exciting. That's a big change in the rollout of psychedelic assisted psychotherapy. And I'll say a little bit more about that. But the primary focus has been working with people who have severe and complex PTSD. So the MAPS criteria for people to participate in the clinical trials was usually either a war vet or someone who had suffered a catastrophic accident. And then they began to expand that, although NYU was a little bit more involved in working with people who have terminal diagnoses. And so the criterion was very specific for who qualified for participation. What's interesting about that is it helped all of these organizations and institutions to gather a lot of research on the efficacy of treating complex trauma with psychedelics. But then over time, they've started to expand that to so-called healthy normals. So people who, and I mean, we have to use quotation marks, any reference to healthy and normal, what are we talking about? Basically, they mean people who do not have an obvious complex trauma history, but who might also really benefit from this modality. And that's, I think, been extremely important to research because the word is out, right? These medicines have become so accessible. So quite helpful to understand its clinical applications and what it is that people are likely to experience if they're not seeking it out for a therapeutic intervention. Yeah. So I thought I would just start with a very brief reference to the neurobiological component, since we're here in this course to explore embodied realities and treatments that address the body. The neurobiology is really fascinating, and there are a number of very nuanced theories on what's happening neurobiologically that allows psychedelics to offer such healing potential. One primary theory is that it takes offline what's known as the default mode network. And again, some of you have probably read about this because a lot of people who are not clinicians who have gotten curious about psychedelics have been doing their own research and sharing it in a more popular vein. The interesting thing about the default mode network is that it's linked with what we think of as the predictive brain. It is our neurological capacity to basically map onto a future experience what we have experienced before. And that protects us from overstimulation, right? So if you get on a bus, you're not thinking, what is this structure with wheels? And what's this purse that I'm holding? And what's inside it? And what's this card? I mean, imagine if you're really stoned, that might happen. right? But because of the default mode network, we are able to carry with us prior experiences and then basically protect against chronic overstimulation of chronically feeling like we're always in novel situations. Very helpful. But the default mode network can also create ruts that we get stuck in. So for people who have severe OCD or severe depression or any severe anxiety condition, there's usually a tremendous amount of anticipation that's involved. And then with that anticipation, too much projection that prevents new experiences from coming in. This seems to be central to the neurobiological reason why psychedelics has been very effective in helping people interrupt patterns that generate acute suffering. Interestingly for Buddhists, it's also the default mode network that generates a sense of self. And one of the reasons why people often experience such revelatory healing when they're doing psychedelic assisted psychotherapy is they suddenly feel relieved of that burden of self-consciousness, separateness of self. Yeah. So we can just be curious about how healing it is when that gnawing sense of self dramatically starts to settle. Yeah. So what seems to happen for people who garner healing from psychedelic assisted psychotherapy is that they do very readily access a sense of interdependence when the DMN, the default mode network, takes that experience of self offline. So for people, for instance, who are dealing with a terminal diagnosis and they've been terrified of loss, right? Terrified of losing connection with loved ones, often they access a feeling of being so intricately connected to the larger world, including their loved ones, that it dramatically reduces the fear of death. Also for people who have prior complex trauma, for war vets, for instance, who may have either watched people die or killed others, who are riddled with feelings of guilt, who again feel separated almost on a, you know, bodied level from others, through psychedelics, they start to feel that they are in connection, right? Even all of those feelings can be woven back into their experience. Yeah. Okay. So I'll come back to that, but that's just a very brief thumbnail sketch of the neurobiology of psychedelics. The next primary component, although this aspect of psychedelics is often insufficiently explored, and now especially with the implementation of psychedelics as a clinical intervention, is spirituality. Because what's been reported, and people like Bill Richards at Hopkins has written about this extensively, is that people tap into a feeling of awe. They tap into affective experience that we tend to associate with religious and spiritual life. Yeah. And so that awe also starts to deepen and maybe expand the sense that they are in connection with all beings, so that the awe is just naturally generated. I mean, if we really walked the earth feeling intimately in connection with others, we probably would be more regularly feeling a sense of awe. But because it's so easy to default to feelings of separateness and smallness and all of the fear that comes with that separateness, the awe often gets hidden by anxiety, right? Hidden by distress. Yeah. So something that I have been curious about, and I'm sensing that we're going to need spiritually oriented clinicians to weigh in on the rollout of this new modality, is how to discern when people don't have the time to use their contemplative practice to access those feelings of interdependence and awe. Because when I was beginning to learn more about these modalities some time back, I was suspect. It seemed to me that there was another route. And there is another route, but not everybody has the time. Right? Some people are living with agony, and they need something to come in to reduce the acute suffering in order for an exploratory therapy to actually offer more benefit. Okay. Even those of you who have done couples work, you know, if you're dealing with people who are so activated, not much can happen that's insight-based, right? Because the nervous system is so dysregulated. Cognition also is compromised. So I just offer that as something to think about, is the discernment, right? Who needs this intervention? Because they may not be able to withstand the suffering as they're more slowly pursuing a spiritual practice where they could work on feelings of interdependence and awe and bliss, etc. Yeah. So just two more things on spirituality before I move on to psyche and trauma. It does seem that there's tremendous common ground between the experience people report on psychedelics. Often it sounds like opening to spacious awareness. It sounds like a deeply heart-centric mindfulness practice where they're noticing a lot, but without the habituated judgments. So even the language is resonant with people who have been doing some contemplative practice over time. And so it generates the question, is there something new in the experience? My hunch is yes, there is something new. And it's going to take more time to appreciate that. It's just that what's novel in the experience is also on a continuum, right? It's both new and it reverberates for people, again, who have some deep history with contemplative practice. It doesn't feel like they have accessed something entirely new. But in all of the descriptions, all of the clinical reporting, there is some reference to a new experience, whether it's because they transitioned from anxiety to safety much more quickly and in a fuller embodied way than they do in their contemplative practice, or whatever else. I mean, I think there are lots of examples. But this is just something to think about especially as you might be learning more about psychedelics. What is it that's novel? What is it that's specific to that modality that couldn't be accessed in other forms of treatment and healing? Yeah. Okay. Let me just pause here for a moment and see if there are any questions. Natalia, hi.
Hello, thank you so much, Pilar. Is it okay to share a comment?
Sure.
Pilar, yes. I started on the Dharma journey student in 2004, and I started to sit with ayahuasca medicine as a form of personal growth and healing since 2006. And they have been instrumental medicine for my personal growth as a clinician and as a person. And they bring me something very profound and very distinct. And they both provide such an amazing way to inquire about non-duality in the way I've used them for growth and healing in my life. And I've been using somatic body work to support a fellow practitioner and participant for 5 years now. And I was just in Peru providing body work integration support for an extended retreat that I was at. And I think like such an important conversation we're having today, because I think like the next phase of supporting those kind of alternative medicine for people is to support the integration aspect. And I think it's relevant both for psychedelic assisted psychotherapy and Dharma studies, supporting people with integration in the way they experience those amazing leap of personal growth and consciousness expanding. So I think the aspect of supporting people with integrating those kind of experiences is very important. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah, this seems like the key, right? How to be collaborative across disciplines. I mean, it's basically why we're here, that we need multiple modalities at times to really feel well and to work through our history.
Yeah. And one other part, Pilar, if I may, you ask a question that is really relevant in terms of what those kind of psychedelic assisted therapy provide. And I think like those healing ceremony, they happen collectively. So I think the collective space as a holder for scream and tears and laughter and all kinds of big processes, the collective aspect, I think, is a very healing one.
Beautiful. Yeah, right, since feelings of connection are so central to the experience and the healing. And I mean, this is why set and setting have been so emphasized in the methodology, to feel like you're with people, you're in community, or you're with mentors that help you feel safe, contained. Thank you. Rob, and then Chris.
I also have a comment that I'll try to keep short and then transition into a question. Like Natalia, I have many years of history in the ceremonial aspects of this, with ayahuasca, and I found it to be very profound. My concern now with where this is heading is a sort of the medical model co-opting it. So I have a client who suffers from depression, and ketamine is the one legal option now. And I thought it'd be a great idea for her to try that. And we set intentions, and she went in, and it was a profound experience. But then every week, the clinic is sending her a mood assessment. And if her mood dips, they want her to go back in for more ketamine. And you know, my view of these medicines is they show your mind where you can go, and then you've got to practice it in your daily life. You bring it into your meditation, you practice it in therapy, that it's not the substance itself, right? And so there's a doctor running this ketamine clinic who's thinking and so she might as well be on antidepressants, which they're treating the drug as the solution. That's the thing that has me banging my head against the wall. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on that, but I'd also like to circle back. I've been thinking since you mentioned it before the break about our defenses, you know, projecting onto our reality, which as Buddhists, you know, we know that even without our defenses fully engaged, we're projecting onto the reality a great deal. But that as we work on our defenses, Pilar, it's a continuum, right? There's things where we know, oh, this is definitely my defenses projecting on the reality. And then there are things that, okay, we think we can ascertain our reality. But right on the edge, where we try as we might, we can't quite discern which is defensive projection and which is reality. Any tips on working that both for ourselves and with our clients?
Sure, thank you. Thank you so much. Maybe to your first point, this is a huge pitfall, and it's something I've been thinking about. And as these medicines are now more widely available, and as profit is available to clinicians and to clinics, it's going to be very tempting to place the agent for change on the medicine. But ultimately, this is both my opinion, and it's an opinion shared by other researchers that I've been conversation with, that the real healing happens in a relational context. So, I mean, it's for this reason that the MAPS methodology involves pretty active relational experience between the patient and the therapists in the preparatory sessions. Then the therapists are present for the several sessions of the journey, and then they're involved in the integration sessions. Ultimately, I think what's going to be needed, both to protect people from getting manipulated or exploited, are clinicians who understand these medicines, but also know that they belong in a relational process, right? Where whatever's accessed can actually be more fully explored and integrated. Because when that doesn't happen, it's a setup for a fantasy that the healing can come from the medicine. And while the efficacy with these medicines is significantly greater than all of the research we now have around antidepressants and anti-anxiety meds, the efficacy with antidepressants and anti-anxiety is around 20%. With psychedelics, it's 80% and above. So that's exciting. That's compelling for people. And it doesn't offer a quick fix. It needs to be part of a longer process. To your second question, Rob, this was something a mentor said to me in my cohort when we were studying with her years ago, that the only way to assess what's projection is to know oneself. This is why we need to continue our own personal work, because that way we're better able to sense, right, when something's gotten activated and it feels true, but there's a heightened affective response she used to say, when it feels like you're foaming at the mouth, first of all, you'll notice it if you're doing your own work. And then you can get curious about what's been stirred that is personal. If you're having a response, and I think in our conversation earlier, many of us were having a response to something that is externally troubling, but we're not leading with insults, right? We're not feeling inclined to demonize. That's a good sign that projection is not the main event here. It's reflective. Right, there's curiosity. Chris?
Actually, I don't think I have a question right now. It's been so helpful to hear this discussion and what you just said. And just hearing about the default network, the default mode network and it going offline as the mechanism. Yeah, it's really helpful to think about it that way. It's really clear. So I'm appreciating this. Oh, and I'm really curious to think further. And I think that we do need to be aware that this is going to be, the insurance companies are going to really have a lot of impact. So, because it's going to save money. So just to, I don't know, it makes me want to just think about that and anticipate.
Yeah, this is a great time to be learning more about this, since what's likely to happen moving forward is that many patients will come in and express interest in having a psychedelic experience or working with a therapist who has some appreciation for it. In a way, what's happening now mirrors what happened 20 years ago or so around therapists who are friendly to spirituality. So this is an opportune time, right, to first of all help patients understand this is a resource. It's not an end game, and that it can be very effective if it's part of a longer term relational exploratory process. Yeah. Thank you. The other thing I'll just add is some forms of suffering will present as treatment resistant. Those of you who have been clinicians for a while, you know what it's like when you are trying everything under the sun. Now, sometimes when the efficacy isn't obvious and there's doubt, we need to be patient and curious about what hasn't been discovered mutually, you know, what's defended against. But sometimes it's an indication that somebody needs something more than what they're experiencing in their treatment. And so many of the people who have been involved in the clinical trials originally did present with treatment-resistant conditions. So often the war vets had tried everything. They did CBT, they did DBT. Right? They did group therapy, they did individual therapy, and it did not diminish suicidality, it did not diminish addictive behaviors. And so that's a good way of discerning. Right? If you have been patiently trying, right, to explore, to work through, it's possible somebody might benefit from this resource. That's been my experience with certain patients who are really debilitated by OCD, right? There are some conditions that are contraindicated people who have more borderline organization, where there's a lot of splitting, they're not good candidates for psychedelic therapy. Even war vets don't necessarily present as borderline because they have had discernible, complicated trauma. Right? It's just left them riddled often with self-loathing and fear, too much suffering. But people who have borderline organization and or mostly problematic developmental thwarting, they're not the best candidates for this modality. Often they do need a deeper, more intensive psychodynamic treatment. And at MAPS, that was disqualifying. So many people were on to the MAPS clinical trials and pursued them. But if they had had an accident, but were also assessed as borderline, they were disqualified. Phil could say much more about that, but I just offer that to you as, you know, as a way to be discerning. So maybe just lastly, for people in spiritual community, right? Often there is the hope that spiritual practice will be the ticket, right, to address complicated suffering, to work through addiction, to work through trauma histories. And I think the shame around psychedelics has really decreased hugely, in part because there are now many revered Dharma teachers who are also interested in psychedelics and have been very open about that. And so it's helping spiritual communities think through in a more integrated way what these resources are for. But I remain curious around the discernment here of when we need to deepen our spiritual practice, when someone needs this additional resource. And similar to how we might need to help people appreciate that it's the relational context that's going to help them get the most out of psychedelics, spiritual practice also, I'm sensing, is going to help people really call deeper meaning from psychedelic journeys, because they'll have methods that they can use every day, right? You can't safely take a heroic dose of psilocybin every day, although there's a lot of microdosing going on. We can do breath work every day. We can be curious about why we're not feeling blissful, and then access some of the tantric practices that we've been exploring in this class. So my hunch is, as we're moving forward with these medicines, for those of you who are drawn to contemplative practice, there's going to be such a beautiful opportunity to help people who have been turning to psychedelics understand the methodologies that are available through the Dharma that might help them get more from the original journey, really weave it into the psyche, weave it into daily life. Yeah. Oh, Victoria. Hi.
Hi, thanks. I'm just curious what you might say, because I guess what's coming up for me too is like it feels like a psychedelic experience, or I've done ayahuasca in a ceremony, and of course it is in community. But I know for me, I notice, and I think it's what you're saying about people who are very severe, like a severe OCD. I can see how that could jolt you out of your habitual patterns And then all of a sudden you're seeing a whole new way of being that you didn't experience before. And that's like showing you, oh, wow, this other thing exists, right? And then, so it's not really like, whereas if we're doing breath work or how could maybe like the visualizations create that same experience for people? Maybe it's not as quick, you know, it's obviously it's not, but if we can experience that through a mentor, for example, would that work similarly, but more slowly? And then how do we deal with, for me, these things have always been like a little patch. I can't, you know, take, like you just said, I can't take that drug every day. I can't. Oh, did I freeze?
Yeah, it's okay.
Did I freeze?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. So if you can't do it every day, because you're not really solving the problem, you're just creating a space. Oops. I think I.
We can see you, and I think if you unmute, we can hear you too.
Oh, can you hear me now?
No.
I can't see anything.
Oh.
But that's okay. That was it. That was just the, you know, the difference between something functioning over time,
yeah,
and changing your brain versus a momentary release and relaxation from what is the stressful experience, which is also helpful, of course, but not the same as a transformation, a trait change, I guess. I just wonder what you had to say about that.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, it's for this reason that I'm sensing psychedelics, ultimately, if it's going to be of more benefit, needs to be grounded in another healing tradition, probably both a clinical and a spiritual healing tradition. The question largely does circle around pace. It takes work. I mean, the mind has to be relatively settled to do visualization practice. If somebody is gripped by the agony of addiction or OCD or complex trauma, the mind is just going to be too distraught to be able to do that work. There might be momentary glimpses, but it might be too little too late. And the physiological, the neurobiologic shift, it does allow people to stay in the experience. This is also a difference. I mean, obviously more advanced meditators can stay in a contemplative state, but for most of us, it takes a lot of work getting there. Right? The mind's thinking about the phone. I mean, I want to check my phone. I'm thinking about sushi. I mean, it's just, it doesn't take much for the mind to want to go somewhere else. But you think about it, if you've just come back from Iraq, you know, and you've watched children lose their life, I mean, the mind is not going to settle very easily. Yeah. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Chris and then Jonathan.
Thank you. The MDMA article had this dramatic example that was like so moving to me, where the veteran has this amazing experience and gets past like his guilt, kind of survivor's guilt. He has this like interaction with his friend who's deceased, who died in combat. And it was just like so dramatic, and I was so like inspired and excited by that. And it did seem like I latched onto like, oh my God, he's like cured. And I have no experience with, no personal experience with this. So I'm curious to know more about like, what are, for those less obvious, like really profound experiences, what can be expected? What kind of changes how much does it really accelerate, if you can speak to that?
Mm-hmm. For people who are in the category of the so-called healthy normal?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, my hunch is it's quite divergent based on what someone's bringing to the experience. Probably any neuroses, anything that has obstructed someone's ability to feel safer, especially interpersonally, is likely to be softened. And again, that takes many different forms, but often the question that people who facilitate will ask after the journey is, did you notice a shift from anxiety to safety? And for many people, it's a dramatic shift, I think in part because that gnawing feeling of separate self has really had an opportunity to settle in such a visceral way. You don't have to work at it. You're just in the reality. And so if there's a history of anticipatory anxiety, if there's a history of over-preparing or berating oneself for not getting things exactly right, that may all get softened. And in a way that's illuminating because the journey becomes a reference point for what's possible. In a way that's not totally dissimilar to how contemplative practice can be a reference point. We know what it's like to be on retreat and you feel like you're very connected to others and there's a lot of compassion, and then back home and we're the usual nutcase, right? So it's helpful though, just to notice, something shifted, right? capable of another state. Thanks, Chris. Jonathan. Jonathan, can you unmute?
Yeah. I know very little about the use of psychedelics at this point, but it seems to me that what's happening is in terms of the use of it for spiritual reasons, that there's some biological chemical hit occurring that can create a real spiritual experience, as you were saying, of awe or boundaries falling, connection occurring. But then there has to be some kind of interpretation of that event. And so what resonated with me was what you were saying about that then has to happen in relationship. And not only a one-on-one relationship, I would think, but in ideally then in a community or a sangha of some sort. I can only relate it in terms of some of my own early state experiences, either through practices or just things that have happened to me. And it's taken me years to understand them better through groups like this, through relationship, through reading and lectures. And even then they change. My understanding of them change as I develop. So I think it is really important what you're saying about, you know, after the experience, right? After that, whatever brain chemistry that change that's going on, that the bulk of the work, and in fact, it seems to me that it could be very dangerous that way then, because there is so much contextualization, I think, that is necessary. Once that goes on. So that makes a whole lot of sense to me, what you were saying.
Thank you. Yeah, it's another reason why people who are using these medicines will benefit hugely from appreciating the psyche, appreciating our subjectivity as a way of understanding that what's experienced is going to be highly subjective, of course, there are categories of experience often, right? Sense of awe, the sense of connection with the divine, sense of connection with the natural world, softening fears, etc. But the specificity of those categories is where the healing can happen when that's more fully explored.
I have, you know, just a couple things to share. I've found that, you know, for clients of mine who have used psychedelics, that there's a way that they can access pre-verbal states that has been very helpful. So I would just offer that when you know that there's some pre-verbal developmental trauma there that that's been very resistant to being contacted. I have seen very good results in terms of psychedelics helping to touch into there. Also for clients who, you know, I do parts work with, they've been then able to bring in a part maybe into their psychedelic experience that also is very helpful because they know that part, but maybe there's still more work to do there. And I've seen that be incredibly helpful. You know, one thing I would name is I have also seen some clients that when they feel stuck in therapy, then they might be more ready to go, you know, I think I just need to call my guide. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, it's also important to, you know, I've sort of have watched for that and what Pilar has been saying about, you know, when there is some resistance to mutually, for things to be mutually revealed, you know, in the therapy, I think it can also be helpful to check in and see, is there something here between us, right, that's blocking something from coming in, you know, and because again, it's not a quick fix and that we don't want the attention to be on the medicine in that way outside of the relational context. So I have had the experience of really checking in on the relationship. What's here between us? Is there, you know, how is this feeling? And I've also really appreciated for those clients of mine who do have a Dharma practice, right? The ability to witness, to bring on their online their witness when they're having a psychedelic experience has been incredibly helpful. So just talking about the cross-pollination, that even if someone's not, you know, that hasn't meditated that much, but they do have even some experience with mindfulness, bringing that to a psychedelic experience is incredibly fruitful.
Yeah, thank you so much. Right, to bring more awareness to an experience that can open awareness. It's a winning combo. Mm-hmm.
There is another comment that I'd like to share, Pilar. In the recent years, they have done studies of how generational trauma can alter the DNA of people, and you can trace higher cortisol level to the descendant. I believe that there's been some preliminary studies with peyote and ayahuasca that it on a biological and organic level it can rewire some strands of DNA, and so that would go along with what Fiona mentioned about the pre-verbal and perhaps going further along. Yeah,
thank you. The research is so helpful in more fully understanding these modalities, right? Since, and thanks, Fiona. I mean, often it's the struggle to access a very early experience that makes therapy such an arduous long-term process. So having other modalities potentially to help people at least trust that there is something there that's powerful but hard to access could deepen the therapeutic process and really accelerate the intergenerational healing process. Thank you. Any other questions or musings? Rob?
Yeah, I could circle back to the relational aspect of things. Because I nodded my head yes when you said that, I remember how you put it, that primarily healing comes from the relational aspect of it. And then I was wondering, well, I guess it depends to some degree on what we mean by relational. If we mean between the client and the therapist, or the medicine participant and the shaman, but when in deep meditation or having a solitary experience with the medicine, you know, even if it's in community, but you're not communicating with others, great insights can take place, right? Whether it's alone meditating or having a somewhat solitary experience. So how do we mesh that with the idea that, let me see, I wrote it down, that healing happens in a relational context?
Yeah. Well, it's a great question because, and we're relational with ourselves, right? We're interpersonally relational with mentors. We're relational in community. In the Dharma, it's suggested that we need all three experiences, relational experiences, in order to heal and to feel well, right? We need a changed way of understanding who we are and changed way of treating oneself, but then we do need mentors with whom we can get some reinforcement, right, to get some concrete help, but also to keep living into that changed relationship to self because of how we're being treated by the other. So I would say with the medicines, the same is going to be true. We need opportunity to reflect. This is where meditation is going to be so helpful, right? To have some capacity to settle in and have a look, see what was experienced. But equally, safe, caring mentors will be needed to be sure that nobody gets harmed, right? That people understand a little more fully the potential, and we'll need community as places where it can be explored and better understood.
And processing.
Exactly. Yeah. Right.
And also Joe said to me one time that, you know, the benefit of, you know, therapists is, we'll keep you honest, right? That I suppose we can if we're on our own, whether it's doing medicine or, maybe we do need somebody to help keep us honest.
It makes sense to me. I mean, given how powerful the unconscious is and how hard it is to see what's in the shadow, we really do need other people who are more or less trustworthy people of integrity to just be able to point out there might be something here that's hard for you to see, but would be beneficial to lift to awareness. And this does come up with journeys too, because the fantasy of what should happen is very powerful for a lot of people. So if there's a clinician participating who can appreciate both the power of fantasy and the gap between fantasy and reality, and then amplify what actually happened, even if it doesn't meet the expectation, that's obviously really beneficial for the participant.
Well, thank you so much, Pilar.
You're so welcome. Thanks, everyone, for being here, for being part of this Sangha. And we'll revisit much of what came up tonight, I'm sure.
So be well, everyone. Thank you again, Pilar. Wonderful discussion and talk. Yes. Lots here to chew on, for sure.
Take good care, friends.
Yes.
A good night.